Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 184 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. The Second Amendment podcast is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my very lovely hostess, Erin Paulette. How are you doing, Erin?
I had a dental appointment today. So, yeah, that was fun. And I'm sure this will come as a hearty guffaw to anyone who knows me and people who listen to me. But I have it from a medical authority that I do indeed have a small mouth. Not a big mouth like people have accused me of. No, no, I have a dainty and petite mouth. You're not laughing.
Oh, I'm chuckling at it. And so this was not just a routine cleaning.
No. This was a I had cavities in the back right lower teeth, like 31 and 32, and some of them were below the gum line. And so, yeah, you know, when the dentist basically, you know, he's got to fish hook my mouth open, and the dental assistant has got the little suction thing in there, and then he sticks in the Dremel tool that's apparently been set on auger mode, and so it's not even the height, it's more of the, and it's vibrating all through my jaw. Yeah, it's not a good time. But the anesthetic is worn off, and I can feel my mouth and tongue, and I'm not in a whole lot of pain. It just sort of throbs at this point, so I'm not very perky at the moment. Yeah, so that was my day. How are you doing, Weird?
I'm doing much better. I am curious for listeners of the show, reach out to me. Let me know when this moment when transitions suddenly stop becoming a big deal on the my daughter going back to school last week.
Oh, that kind of transition. Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. No. Not the Operation Blazing Sword Pink Pistols kind of transition. But yeah, no, my daughter going back to school after the holiday break was a rough ass week. And it seems like she has finally got her feet underneath her, and she's actually been quite pleasant. Though just before the show, she was watching a movie, and I'm like, come on, sweetie, you're gonna go up and get in the bathtub. She's like, but I got 15 minutes left in my movie. I'm like, I'm recording tonight, so I may not have much time to read stories. That's fine. Fast forward to her, my wife talking to her in the other room saying, you still haven't brushed your teeth, but you know, if you're quick, maybe daddy can read a story. And I'm like, look at my watch. I'm like, no, there's not going to be any time for any stories. What? No stories? No one told me about this. So yes, my daughter had a very, very minor, she handled it well enough. But it was definitely an F around and find out moment. So, yeah. But I'm hearing no carnage. So therefore, I assume she is asleep. So yeah, that's been my day. It has been less of a Monday than every other day of the week.
All right. So, shall we just run headfirst into the main topic?
Let's run headfirst into the main topic. There's kind of two. One's really just a precursor. I just wanted to bring it up just because they were interesting. So the first one is what is it? Dominic Black. This would be Kyle Rittenhouse's friend. Who was the friend who was old enough to buy the AR-15 that Kyle Rittenhouse used, and there was a whole lot of confusion on what was going on with the rifle and whether or not it was legal or illegal or cross state lines and all that. And as far as the law goes and anything that the state can prove, Mr. Black was the rightful owner and the possessor of the firearm, and it was just an agreement that when Kyle turned 18 and could take legal possession of it, that then he would take possession of the gun. And for the time of them going to assist people in the riots, they decided they needed firearms, and so that was the firearm that Kyle used. Well, The AG Binger really wanted to get a pound of flesh. He couldn't get Kyle, so he tried to get Dominant Black to pay, and had him charged with all sorts of like felonies. I don't even know the full list of all of them. Let's see if this article has. He was charged in November with two counts of delivering a dangerous weapon to a minor, resulting in death. And was that it? Yeah. So he was charged with some felony crimes, but there was a plea deal reached, and he has pled no contest to contributing to the delinquency of a minor, which in Kenosha, Wisconsin, this is a city crime, and this is a civil infraction. And so, therefore, it is not even a misdemeanor, and he is going to pay a $2,000 fine, and that's the end of the story for him. So, there's a lot to unpack on that. As one, just how much the state was going after him, and because of that, I considered a really, really smart move just to pay the money and get away, just completely clean, but also that they had such a little case that they ended up like settling on this, and why it wasn't all just dismissed in the first place is just disgusting.
It's noteworthy, or at least I think it's noteworthy, that this was held before the same judge, mm-hmm. Judge Schroeder, and he was the judge for the Rittenhouse trial.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not trying to make a point,
yep.
Just more like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So it looks like that's not the end of the Kyle Rittenhouse saga, because the state is going to be going after several of the people that were in the background, such as the guy that was shooting his gun in the air at the time when Kyle shot the first person. So
that would be novel.
Yeah, yeah, it'll be interesting. Of course, I will be very curious to see that case, only because we talked about it in an ACP mag dump, but Binger was on a podcast where he was talking about the case, and he was still going on and on about how Kyle was absolutely a murderer and absolutely guilty and was going there with intent to shooting people and all of this stuff that was proven to be not true in a court of law.
Doesn't that open him up to defamation charges?
It may, but also at the same time, I think Kyle Rittenhouse absolutely constitutes as a public figure, and so therefore he would need to prove malice in that. And
I mean, in general, yes, but considering that this guy is an officer of the law, I don't know. I would think that would make things different, but
I mean, it would be
I'm clearly not a lawyer.
Yeah, it'd be the least of his concerns, given some of the reprimands that he received during the trial and some of the shenanigans that were pulled, such as doctoring the video that was sent to the defense. So I don't know. It is a mess, and it'll be interesting to see how this person who is as far as I know, really much more of a common criminal than Kyle Rittenhouse, who has had a very, very clean background, still has a clean background, and was on videotape helping people, including BLM protesters, before he ended up shooting people who were also on videotape clearly attacking him. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see if the justice is just as skewed the other way around to the people who were attacking Kyle at on this night. So we'll see where it goes.
All right. So what's the other topic?
Yeah. Well, the other court related thing is the three people who were convicted of killing Ahmaud Arbery. They were all sentenced, and pretty much the verdict across the board is they are all getting life in prison. And yeah, I wanted to point this out because I don't think the news media is giving this a fair shake. As this court case was running down, they were constantly talking about the fact that the jury in this case was, I mean, the three gentlemen that, or the three men that have been convicted, they all are white. Ahmaud Arbery is black, and there was only one member of the jury who was black, and so they were saying it's an almost all-white jury, implying that there was going to be some sort of racial lines, and Ahmaud Arbery was not going to get a fair shake in the eyes of the law. And I absolutely felt like this, while the video was not nearly as clear, all the evidence of this case really seemed like it was a dirty shoot, and that was what the jury agreed on as well. And they are going to spend the rest of their life in prison for essentially sticking their nose into business that they really didn't have any business in doing, and ended up taking a man's life. And so may that be a cautionary tale to all of you. I heard a great line once, and it's really kind of stuck in my head, is never draw a firearm for anyone you don't want to go to, that you wouldn't be willing to go to jail for. And this is absolutely one of those cases of the, you know, what are you doing here? And so the last one, I'm trying to remember. Did you send me this one, Aaron? This one got posted.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. This one got posted. So why don't you start it off? Let the people know what this article is all about.
The people deserve to know. Right. Okay. I wasn't expecting this, but I can figure it out. So there is a new bump fire device on the market, but it's not a bump stock. It's something called the Cold Finger. And I think it's called that because the folks who make it are in Alaska, and it gets cold there. And I'm not even going to attempt to describe it. Just follow the links, look at it. But it's a device. It does not go on the gun. You know, you put your hands around the grip, and then you grip the Cold Finger with your fingers, and that enables you to bump fire. And the theory, which I'm not going to test because I love my dogs, is that because this is not something you attach to the gun, it is therefore somehow special and not considered a machine gun. I mean, you know, I'm not going to risk it because this is the same ATF that ruled a rubber band is a machine gun. But I found it interesting, first of all, just for, you know, the ergonomics of it. Secondly, it was a very knowing middle finger to the ATF, because at this point, you know, they know that they're inviting investigation, and I truly hope they've got all their ducks in a row and all their lawyers are, you know, trained and ready to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more attention we can throw at this ridiculous and arbitrary ruling, the better chance we have of taking it down. So yeah, there's that's my take on it, and now you get to talk for longer.
Yeah, well, quoting from this article, this is actually from the makers of Cold Finger, Gusky Works LLC. Finger chip aperture is a novelty hand posturing device that configures the user's hands in such a way as to help the user more easily learn the skills required to bump fire a two-handed semi-automatic firearm. So that is a very, very interesting key. And anybody who's interested, to go into the show notes, I actually put up a bunch of YouTube videos of people doing bump firing with other things. One was actually a guy shooting a pistol with the bump board, which has been around for ages. I mean, it's been around much
10 years.
Yeah.
I do believe it was a 2012 video.
Yeah, but I think it's even older than that. I remember seeing bump boards ages ago. And, you know, it's essentially just the most simple version is just a wooden board with a hole cut in it. and you place it, you know, it's, and, you know, bonus points for making it vaguely shaped like a rifle stock. But then you put your finger through the hole in the board and allow that finger to pull the trigger of the pistol. And it, the recoil will again send the pistol back and reset the trigger. And you continue applying the forward pressure with your hand and you can bump fire. I also have a video of a gentleman. I think he's an IPSC shooter from Louisiana, but he has a series of videos where he says, like, this is what I call the Cajun machine gun. And again, takes a gun. I think that's a CZ-75 and holds the gun in his right hand, puts his left finger into the trigger guard, and then presses the gun into that finger. And that allows you to bump fire. If again, you do the isometrics just right. And lastly, I have a video of a guy shooting an AR-15 off the shoulder. It's just so slightly off the shoulder, but essentially from a fired position, technically you might be able to use the sights. I'm in no way, shape, or form saying that bump firing is at all a valid tactical decision at any point. This is simply a hold my beer and check this crap out a activity. But essentially, bump firing is a technique. It is not a piece of equipment. This is not like a binary trigger where the binary trigger is doing its thing because that's what it's, that's how the gun is designed to work. A bump stock just simply allows you to bump fire more easily. And this hand device allows you to bump fire more easily, but there's nothing to stop you from doing it with everything that you got right now listening to this podcast. And yeah, so that's, so again, big middle finger to the ATF, and hopefully the bump stock ruling will be overturned. I believe it's still in the courts right now because it's just nonsense, because the law says what it says and bump stocks actually follow the law. But we shall see. We are in crazy clown world.
Pivoting from crazy clown world to a clown car, David is here to tell you how your gun might be able to fit more than one type of cartridge in it. Oh, senpai.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. When selecting a firearm, ammunition supply should be a fairly high-level consideration. After all, what's the point of buying a gun that takes unusual or hard-to-find cartridges? Especially these days with ammo shortages of even some of the more common calibers. In this segment, I'd like to discuss firearms that can utilize more than one cartridge. This can either be due to cartridge development history or the ability to switch parts quickly and easily. The following list is not exhaustive, but represents some of the more common cartridge groups likely to be encountered. First on my list is 22 short, long, and long rifle. While 22 long is nearly impossible to find commercially, even in normal times, 22 short is frequently available. Out of a rifle barrel, this diminutive cartridge can not only be extremely accurate, but nearly hearing safe in volume. Either cartridge can chamber in any 22 long rifle firearm, but being shorter, they may not feed through magazines and will almost certainly fail to operate any semi-automatic action. 22 Magnum rimfire is a completely different case design and is not interchangeable in either direction. Next is 32 Smith & Wesson through 327 Federal Magnum. Introduced as a black powder cartridge in 1878, the 32 Smith & Wesson and 1896 follow-on 32 Smith & Wesson Long survived the transition to smokeless powder and are still commercially loaded to this day. In 1984, Harrington and Richardson introduced the 32 H&R Magnum, a lengthened version of the 32 Smith & Wesson Long. It was intended to duplicate the ballistics of the classic 32-20 Winchester cartridge, but in a straight-walled case, and proved to be quite popular with small game hunters. Just over 20 years later, the Federal Cartridge Company lengthened the 32 H&R Magnum and called the new chambering the 327 Federal Magnum. Due to the design lineage, all four of these cartridges can be fired from any 327 Magnum revolver. Charter Arms, Taurus, Ruger, and Freedom Arms have all made revolvers in 327 Federal Magnum. They're also available through custom designs or conversions. This list would not be complete without 38 Special and 357 Magnum. Long considered the gold standard of personal defense cartridges, 38 Smith & Wesson Special was introduced as a black powder cartridge in 1898, but transitioned to smokeless within a year. It is likely the single most common centerfire revolver cartridge on the market. In 1935, due to the efforts of hand loaders such as Elmer Keith, the 38 Special case was lengthened slightly, so it wouldn't fit in older guns, and loaded to higher pressure to produce the 357 Smith & Wesson Magnum. The new cartridge took off like a shot, and achieved legendary status fairly quickly. While unlikely to be encountered these days, both 38 Short Colt and 38 Long Colt will chamber in any 38 Special revolver, and all three cartridges will chamber in any 357 Magnum revolver. There's also the 357 Remington Maximum, a slightly lengthened and more powerful 357 Magnum, but guns chambered in this caliber are rare as hen's teeth, and so is the cartridge. While named similarly, 38 Smith & Wesson is a completely different cartridge, and no attempt should be made to fire it in a revolver chambered for either 38 Special or 357 Magnum. The 38 Smith & Wesson case is slightly larger in diameter and shouldn't fit the chamber of a 38 Special or 357 Magnum revolver. Nor should 38 Special be fired in a 38 Smith & Wesson revolver, as even if it does chamber, the case will likely rupture on firing. Next up, 44 Special and 44 Magnum. A similar story follows the design of the 44 Smith & Wesson Special. Introduced in 1908 as a smokeless cartridge, the 44 Special was well-liked by hunters and target shooters for its excellent accuracy. However, many hand loaders, such as Elmer Keith again, felt it didn't live up to its potential. This was resolved when the 44 Remington Magnum was introduced in 1955 to great fanfare. Again paralleling the 38 Special, the 44 Special was made by lengthening the older 44 Russian case. This means a 44 Magnum revolver can chamber any of those three cartridges. With the popularity of cowboy action shooting, some limited runs of 44 Russian have been made. Next, here come the big boys. 45 Schofield, 45 Colt, 454 Casull, and 460 Smith & Wesson Magnum. This family is another example of incremental development, but with a twist. The 45 Colt cartridge was introduced in 1873 with the Colt Single Action Army Revolver. The 45 Schofield was released 2 years later for the Smith & Wesson revolver of the same name. Due to the design of the Schofield revolver, the cartridge needed to be about an eighth of an inch shorter than the parent 45 Colt. 454 Casull was developed in 1858 during the Magnum craze of that era, and while based on the 45 Colt, it's not only longer, but was also reinforced near the case head. At almost half an inch longer than the already lengthened 454 Casull, the 460 Smith & Wesson Magnum, introduced in 2005, is nearly rifle-like in proportion. In fact, the 300-grain bullet loading equals the muzzle energy of the 4570 government rifle round with the same bullet. A 460 Smith & Wesson Magnum can chamber any of the shorter calibers with corresponding reduced power and felt recoil. Next up, part swapping conversions. Several rimfire single-action revolvers on the market are available with both 22 long rifle and 22 magnum cylinders that can be interchanged with a few moments' effort. The Ruger Single 6 and the Heritage Rough Rider are just two examples of this design concept. For centerfire fans, 45 ACP cylinders are available for some 45 Colt revolvers. EMF sells one for the Pieta 1873-style revolvers, and Cimarron sells one for their Model P revolvers. There have also been custom conversions of Smith & Wesson Model 2545 Colt revolvers involving 45 ACP cylinders that use moon clips. This conversion would also allow the use of 45 gap cartridges in the same handgun. The TC Contender was introduced in the mid-1960s and uses quick change barrels to allow chambering from 22 long rifle to 4570 government in both rifle and pistol configurations. There are also combination guns which have both a rifle and shotgun barrel. These are generally based on the 19th century cape gun concept. Examples include the venerable Savage Model 24 or the modern rendition, the Model 42, as well as the Springfield Armory M6 Scout. Whatever style of firearm is being considered, don't forget to think about ammunition options as well. Just look back at the past year and a half to see the importance of ammunition interchangeability. Good luck and safe shooting.
You have reached the end of David's segment. Weird will now put the links in the show notes, as is proper. Enjoy!
That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook or MeWe pages, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. I'm also a contributor on the Blue Collar Prepping blog, which can be found at bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Okay, so I apparently broke Weird, and he's bent over laughing silently.
The senpai line just killed me, Aaron. That was that was unexpected and brilliant. Thank you.
Parents, ask your kids.
Yes, and I gotta say, when I was listening to this today, I was praising David. I'm like, this is my kind of geekiness. I love nerd dives as much as this, and may I note that there's a Weird Audio Fest coming up next, and David has easily trashed my show notes with his.
So what's interesting about this article is that it actually came about as a result of a request I had for Blue Collar Prepping. Because we were talking about guns. I don't remember the topic. It was last year, so it might as well have been forever ago. And I think I made the offhand comment that, hey, there are some guns where you can use different types of ammo, and that's kind of cool. Because I think maybe we were talking about one of those silly survival guns, like... The Medusa
is exactly what I was thinking about.
There's that one, and then there's also that really weird revolver where each revolver chamber has a different caliber chambering, and then the barrel is just sort of there. but I said instead of all this mess, you know, there are some guns that can take different caliber is like, you know, if you get a 357 Magnum, you can shoot 38 special through it. And so it's like, hey, you know, David is really into this sort of thing. This sounds like a good article for him. And so, listeners, you're getting sloppy seconds. This actually appeared as an article. But hey, it could also serve as an example of the kind of quality you would get if you read Blue Collar Prepping, and if you don't, you're wrong.
Yeah, and I will include, David did not include it in the show notes, but I will absolutely include it in the show notes of the, did you see the video where Ian got his hands on a Medusa?
Oh yes.
And was putting, I mean, the Medusa supposedly can chamber and fire a ridiculous amount of different cartridges, and then he went, but it'll fit even more, and was shooting things like 32 ACP and 7.62 Tokarev out of it. And amazingly enough, I believe he found that the 7.62 Tokarev actually shot better, the gun was never designed to use, shot better than the 9mm that it was designed to use. So, pivoting again, in my latest Weird Audio Fisk, I cover an NPR article about an alleged centrist Second Amendment group. This is a bit of an older video I'm going to do an audio fisk of, but it came up in a Yahoo News article on gun control.
And a Gallup poll taken after the Las Vegas shooting last year showed that 61% of Americans say they'd like to see gun laws strengthened, compared to 11% who prefer fewer restrictions. But it remains a politically divisive issue.
Gun control is divisive only because these polls are so poorly done that they really don't reflect reality. After the Las Vegas shooting, the only gun control we got federally was Trump's bump stock ban, which was done by ATF fiat at his urging. And it's still being challenged on its constitutionality. The states that passed more gun control laws were deeply blue states that already had a myriad of gun control laws.
In tonight's signature segment, we report from Oregon, a traditionally gun-friendly state where a group of gun owners say they're looking for middle ground.
Traditionally gun-friendly, but radical partisan politics has changed that. I will note that these are the same political actors who brought us Defund the Police and the near constant state of violent riots in the city of Portland. And this trend is hardly isolated in Oregon.
Paul Kemp is one of tens of millions of Americans who own at least one firearm. Growing up in rural Michigan, he learned to shoot at an early age.
Being able to go out hunting with your dad and your uncles, and that was kind of a rite of passage. The opening day of deer season, there's no school because half the kids don't go anyways.
So here's our anti-gun activist, Paul Kemp. And he's doing the standard line of, I'm a gun owner, but, and prattling on about hunting. This is what brings us the stereotype of the boomer FUD, the old man who owns all sorts of hunting rifles, who probably hasn't hunted in over a decade because of his health, and talks about the tradition of hunting while openly wanting to ban guns that can be used for self-defense. Also, Kemp is talking about this while he's shooting a 9mm high point pistol with a very poor teacup grip, and points the gun directly at his house as he sets the gun down to check his target. Clearly, his pistol skills are low, and his safety training is poor. But also, why is a man who's probably not destitute pulling out a budget pistol for his PR piece? I wonder if he didn't even own a handgun and decided to buy the cheapest gun he could find at the store for the PBS video.
Kemp never imagined he'd become an advocate for gun control. Then, on December 11th, 2012, came news reports that shocked the Portland area. A 22-year-old man armed with a semi-automatic rifle fired on holiday shoppers and employees at a mall just down the road from Kemp's home. A few hours earlier, the killer had stolen this AR-15 from a friend who didn't report the theft until after he heard news of the shooting.
They're talking about the Clackamas Mall shooting.
I started researching the gun laws within 24 to 40 hours of when Steve was killed.
Meaning, until he had lost a loved one, he had never looked into gun laws, despite being a lifelong gun owner. I point this out to show that while I'm doing a bunch of research for this FISC and populating the show notes that you read, the gun control activists almost always advocate from a position of ignorance. Don't be like the gun banners, kids.
Kemp goes to great lengths to secure his own firearms. He was surprised that there's no legal mechanism compelling other gun owners to do the same.
Not a touch of irony that Kemp allegedly secures his guns under his own volition, not because of legal mandate, but also just admitted that he'd owned guns for decades without even a basic understanding of firearms laws. But somehow a mandate to lock firearms will make a difference. I will also note that in this video we see Kemp secure his high point with one of those cheap trigger locks, the kind that cause negligent discharges if not properly secured, and can very easily be picked up with minimal effort. Check the show notes for a video of a 2-year-old child picking it with a paperclip and a small screwdriver. They can also be bypassed with a small screwdriver or an ice pick. And then he secures it in a cheap locking plastic case. So while Kemp secures his guns, I'll assume that he also didn't just buy some cheap locking equipment to show off for the cameras like I suspect he did with his cheap pistol. He doesn't do it in a way that would prevent access from a determined person or even a mildly curious child. But also, both methods offer zero protection from theft. Kemp's safety is better than nothing, but not that much better, and certainly no substitute for good safety training, which Kemp has showed he has a deficit in.
The gun owner saw the gun was missing before he went to work, and he didn't call police and report it. So, yeah, I think as a responsible gun owner, I would have reported the firearm missing.
Kemp is talking about the mall shooter who killed his brother-in-law. The killer stole a friend's AR-15 and then used it in the shooting. Kemp makes it sound like a lost and stolen law would have prevented this, but the killer appears to have driven directly from his friend's house to the mall. So I highly doubt the police would have been able to figure out where the rifle or the killer was in the time allotted. I will also note that just before the rifle was stolen, the killer and the owner of the rifle smoked marijuana together, which is a federal crime and a crime in the state of Oregon. So the gun's owner may have been reluctant to involve the police, especially when his home smelled of illegal smoke.
In Oregon, there are some groups that are on the far right of the issue, and then there are some groups on the far left of the issue. And there was no voice in the middle.
So he helped start a new group, Gun Owners for Responsible Ownership, or GOFRO for short.
Note that in this report, they have footage of a Gun Owners for Responsible Firearms Ownership meeting. And there are multiple women in red Moms Demand Action shirts. And this group works together with the Giffords anti-gun lobby. So while he makes a claim to be a centrist group, there is zero evidence of that being true.
On this day, they are at a pediatrician's office in Portland demonstrating gun safety locks using a plastic model of a Glock 9.
This will open, and then you would thread the cable lock through here on this type of gun. And then the gun is positively unloaded.
Aha! Okay, I can let the Glock 9 line slide, but I will note it due to all the other mistakes in this video. But what gets me to scream is they're using a molded plastic gun to show how to secure a firearm. Okay, that's great. I like substituting inert gun replicas when you don't need a real one. Except this video shows him attempting to demonstrate a cable lock on a plastic mold. Stop it! Cable locks require the action of the gun to be opened and the cable either be threaded through the action and into the magazine well of a semi-auto pistol or down the barrel and out the action of most guns. The training gun they used can't accept this lock. Why didn't you buy a cheap airsoft gun to show the doctors? Stop doing a bad job and calling it training.
The training is intended to help doctors and nurses better relate to patients who are gun owners. To explain, for example, why gun locks are so important if a child gets a hold of a firearm.
They don't have enough pull in their index finger to pull the trigger. The only way they can do that, and the reason a lot of them get shot, is they turn the gun around this way and they put both their thumbs on it and they pull the trigger and it's pointed right at them.
Okay, this isn't exactly wrong. Young kids have absolutely been shot from playing with a loaded gun in this way. That being said, these kinds of accidental shootings are astonishingly rare. And if a kid does not have the strength to pull a 5-pound Glock trigger, they also don't have the strength to rack a round into the chamber, or the dexterity or knowledge to properly insert a loaded magazine. If you're worried about a toddler playing with your gun, keeping it unloaded is just as good as any lock, even if the ammo is right beside the gun. If you're concerned about older kids playing with your gun, Mr. Kemp's uber-cheap locks are easily defeatable if the desire is there. Again, this strikes me as horrible advice, especially when safety training with firearms is the best solution. Don't child-proof your gun, gun-proof your child.
Kemp says his organization is focused on promoting gun safety rather than gun control. But not all gun owners believe him. The Oregon Firearms Federation considers itself a stronger defender of gun rights than the National Rifle Association.
I don't believe them, but I do believe the Oregon Firearms Federation is a stronger defender of our rights than the NRA. But that is a low bar to clear. They have a great interview with director Kevin Starrett, and I advise you to watch the video for nothing more than his great advocacy for our rights. And I will note this NPR article interviews one anti-gun activist, one anti-gun politician, and one pro-gun activist. But Mr. Starrett does such a good job that 2-on-1 seems to be a fair fight.
Ginny Burdick is majority leader of the Oregon Senate. She's been working on passing gun safety legislation for 20 years. But it hasn't been easy in a state that's been traditionally gun-friendly.
Historically, no one would talk about guns because it would evoke all these strong emotions.
Yeah, when somebody else talks about gun control around me, it invokes strong emotions. We just heard Paul Kemp advocating for criminal penalties for not securing firearms when he secures his own guns with the cheapest junk money can buy. And him suggesting a man who had his gun stolen be charged criminally for not reporting his gun stolen, when such a report would have taken officers away from the scene of the very shooting he's claiming this might have prevented, but totally wouldn't. And note that Ms. Burdick has attempted to ban most semi-auto rifles in Oregon because they are too dangerous, despite law enforcement using these very guns. And the killer at the center of this story attempted a spree killing with an AR-15 and had multiple 30-round magazines and only killed 2 people, wounded a child, and killed himself. Gun control advocates call for restrictions on our freedom and our property and offer nothing in return. That would make any sane person emotional.
Over the years, she's had some successes, like passing a law requiring background checks for private gun sales. But her biggest legislative victory came this summer with the passage of a bill called ERPO. ERPO, modeled after similar laws in 3 other states, went into effect in Oregon on January 1st. It's intended to reduce suicide. In Oregon, 82% of gun deaths were due to suicide between 2010 and 2015.
Extreme Risk Protection Orders, or ERPOs, are just another name for red flag laws. As I've said countless times, these are some of the worst laws out there for gun owners. At their worst, they're a carve-out for where people can have their rights violated without any criminal charges being filed or any serious evidence being presented. So it'd be very easy for these laws to be abused. But even at their best, it means a suicidal person has the police intrude on their home, confiscate their guns, and then leave them, feeling violated and betrayed with no further supervision. How does this make sense? If somebody is a threat to themselves or others, we should be looking after the person, not their damn guns.
In a surprise move, Republican Senator Brian Boquist, an Army veteran with high marks from the NRA, co-sponsored the bill. His stepson, also a veteran, used a firearm to kill himself in 2016.
Kevin Start of the Oregon Firearms Federation has a far better response than I could come up with.
That's a tragic loss, you know. And as I said, you know, when his stepson took his life, we sent a note to his wife. She sent back a very nice thank you note. I've known Brian for many years. But here's the thing. If he knew his stepson was in crisis, he should have done something. If he didn't know his stepson was in crisis, then this bill wouldn't have helped.
Well said. If somebody is in crisis, a familiar and loving face will do far more to calm a hurting friend than strangers with arrest powers looking to take your guns, by force if necessary. Also, if you can convince your friend to go seek professional help, a voluntary commitment won't remove any rights from your loved one.
You know that there's a slippery slope and that you say that you're just passing some gun safety measures, but that your ultimate goal is to severely restrict people's rights to firearms.
Yeah, nothing.
How can you ensure that that's not?
Nothing could be farther from the truth. For one thing, this is a high gun ownership state, and we are a relatively high gun ownership country. So you're not going to get anywhere without the acceptance and endorsement of gun owners. You just are not.
And this is the crux of gun control in America. The people who propose gun control do not respect the Second Amendment, and they don't like any guns. Paul Kemp may think that a bolt-action hunting rifle or a single-stack high point is a fine gun to own, but Michael Bloomberg and Mark Kelly and Ginny Burdick want you to have none of those. But if they tried to ban all guns, they wouldn't have any support from gun owners, hence why they attempt to divide us. We have boomer FUDs calling for bans on AR-15s and AKs and magazines that hold more than 10 rounds while they're happy to keep their revolvers, 1911s, and duck and deer guns. We have permitting, training, and safety requirements that will price out low-income people while allowing wealthy people to simply purchase their freedoms. This allows them to get support from some gun owners while shrinking the gun-owning population. Until you have a place like Massachusetts, where the Battle of Lexington and Concord was fought by armed citizens against the British Army, which happened to be one of the largest standing armies in the world. And now, here in Massachusetts, gun owners are a minority. We must not only fight for our rights, but also welcome in new gun owners into the fold. While gun control is highly partisan now, I welcome more pro-gun Democrats to stand up against these horrible laws and dishonest politicians. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
Is it just me, or does it seem like, I don't know, every 5, 7, 10 years, there's some sort of hot new gun group that is apparently middle ground and is pro-gun but is also pro-gun control, and then it just slowly collapses like a souffle in the cupboard?
I mean, I think there's always a bit where there is a very, very small number of people, and I think they're really getting even smaller, of it's almost exclusively done by people who are left wing. And again, I hate that the Second Amendment is such a partisan issue, but like super duper left wing people, but also avid hunters and sports shooters, but not, you know, self-defense Second Amendment people. And so they feel that, oh, I have guns and I'm a responsible gun owner, and there's all this gun crime and stuff, and not really going to look at the root causes of that in the least, but I'm going to just claim that people aren't responsible enough. And so therefore I'm going to be a gun owner that supports reasonable, you know, gun control laws and reasonable shooting. and all that. And it just, it almost always gets propped up by the anti-gun groups. That's it, of the anti-gun groups looking for street cred on the, see, we're not just going to come take your guns away. We have, you know, this person, Stephen Gutowski, just recently interviewed the former CEO of Kimber. I forget his name, but he's now working for Giffords and acting like, hey, I support reasonable gun control laws, but I think we should have some gun, you know, some gun laws, and but I think we should also have some gun control worked in here. And it's one of those like, yeah, but Giffords doesn't, like, they are literally just using you. And I've met a few people who have been gun owners that have worked for anti-gun groups, and it was very obvious that they were completely being used. They needed someone that could talk about gun stuff and answer the gun questions, but also a way to make them look less ominous and less willing to take everything from us. And then there's just the straight up false flags, like American Hunters and Shooters Association, whichever, I'm trying to remember exactly the name of it, but it was a group that popped up out of nowhere to endorse Barack Obama for president. And it was run by Joe Rosenthal from Massachusetts was the original head of it. And then people found out about the fact that he is like a rabid gun banner. And so he stepped down and some sports figure stepped up. And yeah, and then as soon as Obama got elected, we never heard from them again. Huh, go figure.
Wasn't there something, Smoke and Thunder, something like that? I mean, it was all the rage among the various gun blogs briefly.
That's not ringing a bell.
Don't worry about it. I'm horrible with names. I just remember he showed up on, I think it was Miguel's blog, and a whole bunch of us just ripped him a new one.
Oh, interesting. Well, yeah, if you track that down, throw it in the show notes, and people can go find the show notes of where we figured it out. But
I believe he called me a goth toddler.
Oh, that's sweet. Bless his heart.
It was like, oh, sweetie, I've been called so much worse by so much better. Okay.
Well, I think we've done this show in, so now it is time for me to thank each and every one of our listeners. That's right, I'm thanking you. And a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To be our Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/SwordCalibersPodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like the hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends, both online and off. I'm totally not reading this from a script, honest.
And you get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's W-E-E-R-D world.com. I'm getting very Shatner here. And I'm also on Handgun Radio.
And yeah, you know where to find me. Yeah, so last week I said I was making myself accountable, and hey, I did. And so I've got a Google form. I guess it's called one of those you go to Google and you answer questions. And so if you were a Blazing Sword instructor and you instructed, educated, however you want to verb it, last year, go ahead and go there and let us know. And if you were a student of a Blazing Sword volunteer, please go and fill that out and let us know, so that I can know the scope of our outreach and how well we're doing and if we need to make anything better. And so I'm not going to read it out because it's a URL with all sorts of garbage characters, but it'll be in the show notes. Won't it, Weird?
Oh, it absolutely will be.
Right.
And thanks to Nate Spencer for our lovely music.
He's Dare Dare, I'm Sun Sun. Our Japanese schoolgirl personality types are sorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Teehee!